Chapter 7 Diamonds and the Rough Lace and Luxury The Lace Maker Greek, sir, is like lace. Every man gets as much of it as he can. Samuel Johnson James Boswell's The Life of Samuel Johnson, 1791 A girl looks down at the work between her hands, utterly absorbed. She's seated in a spare, pale room, so bereft of detail that it's difficult to say whether it is a room at all or a void, hollowed out by her singular focus. Her dress is a glowing lemon shade. Her hair is gathered away from her face in a coif of plaits and large ringlets. Our eyes follow hers, down between her fingers to the V formed by a pair of bobbins she is using to create a piece of lace. The girl, we do not know her name, was painted by Johannes Vermeer towards the end of his career in 1669 or 1670, possibly for Peter Klaas, a fellow artist of the Dutch Golden Age. The painting is known simply as The Lace Maker. 2 years after it was painted, the artist was ruined by the financial collapse set off by the invasion of the Netherlands by King Louis XIV of France. Vermeer's luminous canvases, previously so sought after, furred with dust in his studio as the wealth of his erstwhile patrons evaporated like puddles on a hot day. He died after a short illness in 1675, leaving his wife and 11 children severely in debt. The Lace Maker, however, was painted at a time when Vermeer was prosperous. Assurance oozes from every brushstroke. The canvas reflects the confidence of a well-to-do age and nation. The artist passed the majority of his life in Delft, a bijou city hemmed in between The Hague and Rotterdam, and, during the 17th century, brimming with merchants, Delftware factories, and tapestry ateliers. Although one of the smallest canvases that Vermeer produced, just 24 centimetres tall and 21 wide, when it was first displayed in the Louvre in 1870, it greatly impressed an ambitious 29-year-old painter. Auguste Renoir proclaimed to anyone who would listen that it was the most beautiful painting in the world. The palette largely conforms to Vermeer's preferred triumvirate of pearly grey, yellow and blue. Vincent van Gogh, another fan, wrote that these colours were as characteristic of him as the black, white, grey, pink is of Velázquez. It was one of a series Vermeer worked on between 1669 and 1672 that tenderly showed women absorbed in simple domestic tasks. Contemporaries would have seen the painting as a comment on feminine virtue. Needlework was considered a worthy engagement for women, keeping them at home, occupied, and out of trouble. In a slightly earlier treatment of the same subject by Caspar Netscher, another Dutch genre painter, the idea of virtuous industry is hammered home with additional symbols. Again, the young woman is sitting absorbed in her lace making. She is angled away from us, her face modestly in shadow. A broom against the wall speaks of housework and an ordered home. Mussel shells at her feet suggest safe enclosure, and a pair of discarded clogs imply that the woman has no intention of going outside. She is content to remain within her natural sphere. Vermeer dispensed with such allegorical props. His subject is positioned very close to the viewer, angled three-quarters on, yet unaware of being observed. There are several depths of field within the painting, which Vermeer manipulates to pull us into the middle ground. In front of the girl and slightly to her right, in the extreme foreground, is a table covered with a carpet that falls in heavy folds and is topped with a blue and white sewing box, slightly ajar, and spilling a confusion of vermilion and white threads. The treatment of the loosened threads and of the gold and red design of the carpet is diffused and out of focus, drawing the viewer's eye to the painting's pin-sharp centre, her hands deftly working the bobbins. Vermeer's use of light heightens the effect. Highlights fall on the simple linen collar on her left shoulder, the left side of her forehead, nose, and finally those poised, precise fingers. The painting's size, its foreground filled with a profusion of intriguing objects, and finally, the captivation of its subject in her task, all work in concert to make the viewer lean forward towards the canvas. The Lace Maker can also be interpreted as a meditation on craft, creativity, and the human capacity to spin beauty out of the humblest materials. White linen lace, after all, originates from humble seeds sown in the earth. Conversely, however, it is also one of the best examples of a decorative luxury fabric. It serves no function other than advertising the status, taste, and wealth of its wearer. It provides no warmth and is exceptionally delicate, liable to snag and tear, leaving a careless wearer disgracefully tattered. And yet, during this period, European society, men and women alike, were consumed with the desire for this frippery, to the point where its lack would elicit comment. As a result of its popularity and the price it could command, it provided so much prestige and employment that diplomatic relations between countries could be strained by the ebb and flow of production and consumption. Stitches in the air. I consider lace to be one of the prettiest imitations ever made of the fantasy of nature. I do not think that any invention of the human spirit could have a more graceful or precise origin. Gabrielle Chanel, L'Illustration, 1939. If we were able to disturb the assiduous lace maker in Vermeer's painting so far as to ask her the origins of her craft and why it was so sought after, she would likely have struggled to answer. Lace evolved rather than appearing from thin air. It is also, for similar reasons, difficult to define. Calling it a non-woven fabric made with a needle and thread or threads wound onto bobbins, as some do, would mean that knitting and macrame are also forms of lace. The earliest ancestor is perhaps filet, a needlecraft of square meshes made with a shuttle or needle. It was known in antiquity, but began to be embroidered to make necessarily geometric but distinctly lace-like designs during the 16th century. Lace's real progenitors, however, were embroidery, which was increasingly being used to decorate the edges and seams of the fine linen beloved of Europeans during the 15th century, and passementerie, ornamental trimming made of braid or cord. Its evolution is reflected in a hopeless muddle of descriptive terms. There are references to lace during the 15th century, but these are probably cording rather than true lace. And although the terms did become less fluid as lace became more established, relying on terminology alone is unwise. Take, for example, the trimmings used by English royalty during the 16th century. Passmens of gold and passmain riband worn by Mary I and Edward VI respectively were likely braid, but the passmain lace of bonework of gold that appeared in 1553 in the Lord Chamberlain's accounts was probably the real thing. By the mid-16th century, lace had taken a firm grip on fashionable dress for both sexes and, with a surprising degree of consistency, across Europe. Initially, it was produced as much by skilled amateurs for their own consumption as it was by professional needleworkers. Printed pattern books have survived from as early as 1524. Single sheet designs were likely being published earlier that show lace designs women could copy. Adrian Poyntz wrote in 1591 that these works belong chiefly to gentlewomen for to pass away their time in virtuous exercises. Most lace workers, and certainly those producing the bulk of the lace sold in the open market, probably learned organically from their families or by watching others. Nevertheless, such printed guides may have had a role in the rapid diffusion of various forms and styles of lace through Europe. One book, for example, Matteo Pagano's catchily titled Giardinetto Novo di Punti Tagliati e Croposi per Esercito e Ornamento delle Donne, which was originally published in Venice in 1542, was reprinted around 30 times elsewhere in Europe. Technical instructions were rarely included. It was taken for granted that those consuming these guides would be proficient with the stitches required to build up the often fiendishly complex designs. Needlework, in fact, was one of the few occupations that women of all classes were encouraged to develop. Mary, Queen of Scots, and Catherine de' Medici were both famous for their love of needlework. The estate of the latter included thousands of pieces of elaborately embroidered fillet that she had made, including some complete bed furnishings. The raw material for all this industry was usually fine linen thread. This is what was used to create the pearlescent white laces that encircle necks and wrists in nearly all 16th and 17th century portraits. It is also the variety most likely to survive in collections, but other materials were also used. Black lace, made from silk rather than linen, became very fashionable during the mid-17th century, while with white lace, the desired effect was a strong visual contrast between the lace and the surrounding fabrics. Black lace was more often used with equally dark fabrics, lending subtle texture only noticed by discerning eyes. The effect can be appreciated in a grand portrait of Laurence Rael, painted by Cornelis van der Voort, sometime around 1620, shortly before the artist's death, and now on view at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Laurence Rael was an important commission for van der Voort. He had recently returned to the Netherlands after a three-year stint as the Governor General of the Dutch East India Company, one of the most prestigious posts of the age. This portrait was a carefully crafted record of his triumph. Van der Voort was possibly chosen for his skill as a painter of luxurious fabrics. Rael certainly put thought into his clothing. He wears elegant lace cuffs and a ruff à la confusion, a style with intentionally irregular folds or sets, rather than with a regular SSS-shaped configuration. His sleeves are braided with gold, and there is a little puff of gold lace behind the knees of his breeches. Both these and his doublet are made of a rich, sheened fabric, likely silk, decorated with textured stripes of black lace or cord. Although used extensively in clothing and interiors during the 17th century, the 1624 will of Lord Dorset, husband of the well-known peeress Lady Anne Clifford, even mentioned the green and black silk lace that decorated his coach, black lace is often overlooked. In part, this is because it is less striking in portraiture, but another, more prosaic reason is that very little has survived to be studied. The mordant used to fix the black dye to the silk was acidic, making it brittle and fragile and, in most cases, eventually consuming it altogether. Fragility was less of a problem for another kind of lace coveted during the 16th and 17th centuries, however. The idea of using thin metal threads or wires to create delicate and decorative meshes was not new. Homer picturesquely refers to veils of golden netting in the Odyssey. But laces woven from metals became particularly popular during this period with those who wanted to make their consumption even more conspicuous. When in 1577 King Henry III of France sought to intimidate the Estates General, a legislative advisory assembly made up of groups of his subjects, he turned up to a meeting wearing 4,000 yards of gold lace. The wardrobe of Queen Elizabeth I must have been stiff with the stuff. She bought a great deal and used it lavishly. A single petticoat had 8 yards of gold and silver worked onto it. Because they were so expensive, gold and silver laces were beloved of royalty and the richest aristocracy. Those lower down the social scale might make do with stuff fashioned from copper instead. Moralistic contemporaries, predisposed against all lace as a symbol of vanity, were particularly appalled by metal laces. Philip Stubbs, in his fulminating tract, An Anatomy of Abuses, written in London in 1583, railed, seemingly caught between disgust and admiration, against ruffs clogged with gold, silver, or silk lace of stately price, wrought all over with needlework, speckled and sparkled here and there with the sun, the moon, the stars, and many other antiquities, strange to behold. As with the black kind, relatively few examples survive. Although they were usually too precious to become corroded, these laces were often melted down so that metals might be reused. In France, they were outlawed outright at certain times, since the metal was desperately needed to make coins. In his diary of Friday the 12th of August 1664, Samuel Pepys, whose career success is mirrored by his increasingly extravagant lace purchases, mentioned going to Stevens the silversmith to change some old silver lace. Presumably the exchange was for money. His next stop was to buy new silk lace for a petticoat. Lace was always a luxury deployed to display wealth, taste, and rank. Its value as a signifier of social status lay in its delicacy, its manufacture, and its expense. So potent was it as a status symbol that its wearing was regulated by law to prevent commoners from using it to masquerade as their social betters. One English proclamation, passed in 1579, forbade ruffs made or wrought out of England to be worn under the degree of a baron's son, a knight, and gentleman in ordinary office, attending upon Her Majesty's person. In Venice, the population of the Jewish ghetto were forbidden to wear white needle lace, gold and silver laces, or any bobbin laces wider than the breadth of four fingers. Flax was a difficult and time-consuming crop to grow and process. Spinning and weaving it, particularly if the end result was to be of the best quality, required great skill. Lace was a continuation along the same trajectory of luxury consumption. Constructed from miles and miles of pearlescent linen thread, both the design and execution demanded consummate dexterity, forethought, and no small amount of mathematical acumen. Only five bobbins are visible in Vermeer's painting, but the most complex laces might require 600. Scrupulous planning was needed to ensure the right number of bobbins would be available throughout the execution of a design. The desired effect was of lightness. The perforations allowed glimpses of the fabric or flesh beneath. Initially, this was achieved through cutwork, a form of embroidery where a design on linen is reinforced with buttonhole stitch, and then the enclosed areas are cut away or drawn threadwork, where weft threads are removed from woven cloth and the remainder arranged into patterns and decorated with embroidery. Soon enough, however, a greater airiness than either of these two methods could produce was desired, and so skilled needleworkers in Flanders and Italy, debate about the country of origin has raged ever since, began approaching the problem from the other direction. That is, rather than removing fabric, either by pulling out individual threads or by cutting out sections, it made more sense to start from scratch, building up a design stitch by stitch. There are, broadly speaking, two ways of making lace, with bobbins or with needles. The former has much more in common with passementerie, the kind of decorative trimming common on formal military uniforms, while the latter was descended directly from embroidery. Bobbin laces are traditionally built up over a pattern, during this period often made of parchment, which would be pinned to a pillow firm enough to keep the design taut as it was created. In the lace maker, the printed pattern is visible as a thick pink line over the cerulean sewing cushion on which her hands rest. The design would be marked in the pattern by a series of pricked holes, which indicate where the stitches need to be to create the design. The threads, which are wound onto pairs of small wooden spindles or bobbins, are then plaited, twisted, knotted, or woven together over the printed pattern. As the work progresses, pins are placed in the holes to hold the stitches in place, while the next series of threads are manipulated. Eventually, these pins can be removed. Needle laces, as the name suggests, are made using needles rather than bobbins. Lace makers would also use parchment patterns to guide them in making needle laces, but the designs would be drawn out rather than indicated by holes. Needle laces are made up of rows of detached buttonhole stitches, which are cast between an outline structure made from thicker threads. Punto in aria was an early Italian variant of needle lace. Its name means literally stitches in the air. Both types of lace, and the many variations born of them, were highly responsive to the whims of fashion and demand. Regions across Europe would perfect an idiosyncratic new design that would capture the hearts of the elite, only to fall from favour and suffer a crash when a new darling was discovered. During the 16th and 17th centuries, designs veered from the geometric and impersonal to the voluptuous and baroque. Laces could be specially designed and made, or commissioned to show symbols or words that had special meanings to their owner. A bed cover dating from 1588, for example, was decorated with a siren combing her long hair while gazing at her reflection in a mirror. The words, "Vertu pas tout," virtue isn't everything, are emblazoned across it. It likely belonged to a courtesan. No matter who the owner, cuffs, undergarments, and furnishings of so impractical a material betokened wealth. Not only did you have to buy it in the first place, but lace also had to be maintained and replaced. This implied staff and fastidiousness, in an age where cleanliness and grandeur were virtues available only to the few for a hefty sum. Decency in Georgian England, for example, demanded a clean linen shirt for each day of the week, necessitating a great deal of labour and expense. During the 16th and 17th centuries, soap was a luxury item. In continental Europe, fine, expensive kinds were made from vegetable oils. In England, the common kind was made from tallow, or rendered beef fat, which was also needed for candles. Soap was therefore heavily taxed to prevent tallow candles from becoming exorbitant, so keeping laces clean was supremely difficult. In 1753, an English parson dreaded the arrival of his stepmother and sister for a visit precisely because of all the extra washing their visit would necessitate. Though she offered to hire washerwomen and pay for soap, he wrote, "yet coals, especially with us, is a very great article. Besides the continual fuss and stir there would be with wet clothes." The practical pointlessness of lace was picked up on by contemporaries. Thomas Fuller, a 17th century English writer, called it a superfluous wearing, because it doth neither hide nor heat. But those who expressed such beliefs generally carried on wearing lace regardless. It was as much a part of fashionable dress as breeches. Besides, as Fuller admitted, it doth adorn. Rough diplomacy. Out of the way. We are in the throes of an exceptional emergency. This is no occasion for sport. There is lace at stake. Elizabeth Gaskell, Miss Pole in Cranford, 1851. During the mid-1660s, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the French Minister of Finance and Trade, had a grave problem. The extravagance of his king and court were threatening the financial well-being of the nation. It is no accident that today Louis XIV, also known as the Sun King, is a byword for extravagance. His childhood, marred by political unrest and several humiliating flights from Paris, was largely spent bathing in the intense glow of his mother's devotion. Possibly something in this mixture, devotion and excess seasoned with fear and intrigue, was responsible for the king's appetites when he came into full possession of his throne. For example, he gave Athénaïs de Rochechouart de Mortemart, his blonde-haired, witty and exceedingly fertile mistress of nearly a decade, apartments at Versailles on the same floor as his wife's, as well as a chateau. Not to be outdone in frivolous expenditure, Athénaïs employed gardeners to plant 8,000 daffodils for a single spectacular season. Naturally, this extravagance was also expressed in purchases of lace. Louis favoured a style of collar known as col à rabat, which resembled two large rectangles fastened with a knot under the chin, worn with matching cuffs and ringrave, very full blousy breeches gathered at the knee with a frill, or canyons, little lace collars worn around the knees. Nor was the king's enjoyment of lace confined to wearing it. An inventory of royal goods taken in 1667 reveals that the pleasure barks he used to sail around the Grand Canal at Versailles all had peekaboo curtains over the alcoves. The problem from Colbert's perspective was that almost all this profusion of lace was imported from Venice. Venetian gros point, or point de Venise, is one of the easiest kinds to distinguish. Coming from the Baroque aesthetic tradition, it is characterized by heavy, scrolling motifs, sometimes incorporating oriental flourishes like pomegranates. What made it exceptional, however, was that some of the motifs were picked out with a core of thicker threads over-sewn with buttonhole stitches, giving a lush, three-dimensional effect, quite unlike anything being produced elsewhere. It became the most highly prized style in Europe in the mid-17th century, taking over from Flemish lace, which was pearlier and more delicate. Each large purchase of Venetian gros point the Sun King made, while no doubt adding to his fashionable cachet, was money that Colbert felt would be far better spent on French craft. The problem was that while France did have some lace-making centres, particularly in the north of the country around Normandy, it didn't have a clearly defined style and was therefore not in much demand. Colbert, though, was a man of action, and so on the 5th of August 1665, he announced that factories for all kinds of threadwork, made either with the needle or on the cushion, in the manner of laces which were made in Venice, were to be set up in a number of French towns, including Arras, Reims, Château-Thierry, and Alençon. He called on the royal designers and painters to contribute fresh designs that would only be made by the official royal factories. This new French lace, he declared, would be called Point de France. This alone might have been enough to irk the Venetian state, for whom lace was an important source of revenue. But Colbert went further. He called on needleworkers from Italy and Flanders to emigrate to France, enticing them with promises of citizenship. He kept in close contact with the French ambassador in Venice. Most of their letters were in code, so sensitive had diplomatic relations become. Those that aren't, however, reveal that the French were deliberately siphoning off detailed information about the industry, quoting figures for levels of production and prices. This was, in other words, state-sanctioned industrial espionage, which the Italians weren't prepared to take lying down. Venice promptly issued a counter-decree, commanding those tempted by Colbert's offer not to take it up, and those who had already done so to return immediately, on pain of execution for treason. It was too late. In a few years, the French lace makers had acquired a distinctive style of their own, more austere and regular than Venetian gros point, and full of symbols alluding to Louis XIV, suns, sunflowers, fleurs de lis, and crowns. 7 years after Colbert's proclamation, the inventory of a merchant who specialized in Venetian laces included laces à la Colberta. These were among the most expensive of his stock. It was very much in tune with the tastes of the French court, and particularly those of Louis himself. In a single month, July 1666, the French king bought Point de France worth 18,491 livres. Colbert, eyeing the growing heft of the national purse, must have been delighted. The lace wars between France and Venice during the late 1660s were not the only international squabbles caused by lace. In 1662, an act originally passed some 3 decades earlier that forbade the selling in England or the importation of any foreign bone lace, cutwork, fringe, buttons, or needlework made of thread, silk, or any or either of them was reinforced. Charles II, just back from poverty-stricken exile in Europe, refused to be balked by his own prohibition, circumnavigating it by licensing a single merchant, his own, to import the much-coveted Venetian lace. The merchant responded to the royal favour by charging his client vast sums thereafter. A single bill from the 2nd of July 1668 shows the king was charged £80.08.01 for lace, which included some fine point de Venise at 32 shillings per yard. Lace-producing regions and cities in Italy, the Netherlands and France vied with each other to create new designs. This acted like an engine, driving changes in fashion, expertise and innovation, but also provided a canvas for cultural, political and nationalistic ideas. During the early part of the 17th century, for example, the towns of Flanders were among the most prosperous in Europe, thanks to the foundation of their East India Company in 1602. Flemish lace, which was particularly fashionable at this time, was filled with naturalistic motifs of flowers like carnations, narcissi and tulips, blooms that held special significance in Dutch culture, whereas French laces were more likely to contain motifs that referenced the Sun King. Differences were also discernible in consumption. When Finis Morrison, a gentleman from Lincolnshire who travelled around much of Europe during the 1590s, visited Poland, he noted that the Queen, who was Austrian by birth, was attired like the noble women of Germany. Her new countrymen, on the other hand, appeared most odd, having no ruffs nor any bands of linen about their necks. In Switzerland, Morrison sniffed that, since most of the inhabitants were merchants, they dressed modestly in grave colours, little beautified with lace. Italians never took to ruffs with quite the same gusto as the English, French and Spanish, who allowed them to grow as enormous as prize pumpkins. The largest kinds, which puffed out all around the face like halos, were perfect for displaying particularly intricate laces. To show them off to their best advantage and prevent them from drooping under their own weight, wire frames were made to support them. Thick, multi-layered ruffs had another effect. So much lace was required that it could no longer be consistently supplied by the ladies of the household themselves. By the final decades of the 16th century, lace had become a commodity, traded, bought, and sold by haberdashers who sourced it from workshops, convents, and orphanages, and dealers who traded internationally. Abbey de Langeres, Clothes of the Linen Merchant, a 1695 engraving by Nicolas de Larmassin, gives some idea of how consumers would have encountered such choices. The subject is a woman, the linen seller of the title, wearing a very tall frilled cap, standing in her shop, and looking out at the viewer as if they were a favoured customer. In a somewhat surrealist touch, however, her body is being subsumed by her own wares, so that it's almost impossible to tell where one ends and the other begins. Her bodice contains drawers, each labelled with a different variety of lace: Flanders, Mechlin, Rabat and Dutch. On the table from which her cabinet body emerges, there is yet more lace, this time from Le Havre, nestled among the linen stockings and shirts. French lace makers had Colbert to thank when Point de France became the height of European fashion. Unfortunately for them, however, his successors were a good deal less assiduous in their care. As a relatively fledgling endeavour, it didn't have a long-standing reputation on which to rely, and soon began to suffer as the incentives Colbert had used to entice and encourage it were stripped away. A decisive blow was dealt by the Edict of Fontainebleau in 1685, which struck down the religious protections the Protestant Huguenots had enjoyed in France since the Edict of Nantes nearly 100 years previously. Since the Huguenots had traditionally played a vital part in the industry, it was a devastating blow when so many left the country, taking their skills with them. In Normandy alone, the number of lacemakers fell by half. Other countries wrestled with different issues. The Italian lace industry, particularly in Venice, was bolstered by its reliance on wealthy patrons and the nimble lace-making fingers of nuns in Italian convents, whose prices were relatively low, since they did not have houses to run or families to look after. Lace-makers in Flanders, however, had no such insulation from economic shocks. The same financial crash that felled the fortunes of Vermeer resulted in profound hardship for even the most skilled of Flemish lace-makers. Wearing it well. But the Queen, being in mourning for the Duc d'Alençon and the Prince of Orange, was dressed in black velvet, sumptuously embroidered with silver and pearls. Over her robe, she had a silver shawl that was diaphanous like a piece of gossamer tissue. Leupold von Wedel, 27th of December, 1585. In 1593, Sir John Fortescue, the English Chancellor of the Exchequer, was quizzed by the House of Commons about Queen Elizabeth I's expenditures. As for her apparel, he said, it is royal and princely, beseeming her calling, but not sumptuous or excessive. Although during the centuries since her reign, the depth and richness of Elizabeth's wardrobe has become notorious, in fact, she was in line with her near contemporaries, such as Mary Tudor, Catherine of Aragon, and Christina de Lorena. Clothes were important words in the language of social interactions, queens of small European countries being eyed up by much larger and wealthier rivals needed an expansive vocabulary. Lace, like a rhetorician's elocutio, provided persuasive final flourishes. Queen Elizabeth I certainly did possess an awful lot of lace, though. In the famous pelican portrait painted by Nicholas Hilliard, she is cobwebbed with it. There are narrow bands of gold lace mounted in stripes over the Queen's blackwork embroidered linen sleeves and partlet, a kind of yoke or dickey, worn to cover the neckline, which is also edged with black needle lace. Her cuffs and ruff are made of fine cut work with delicate lace points. Hilliard went to a great deal of trouble to depict it all. When seen in a raking light, it's clear he thickened the white paint he used to do the lace especially, so that it's slightly raised, like the veins on the back of a leaf. The Hierarts portrait, painted around 1592, depicts her in so stiff a white gown and cloak that she looks less like a human than some kind of strange pale crow. Adding to the inhuman effect is the very large cutwork ruff encircling her neck, further distorting the proportions of her body. This fashion, incidentally, was a special target for the kind of Englishman who so enjoyed fulminating on the topic of sartorial modesty. Great and monstrous ruffs, wrote Philip Stubbs in An Anatomy of Abuses, whereof some be a quarter of a yard deep, yea, some more, very few less. Not only were they immoral, they occupied time and thought that many believed would be better spent in prayer. A ship is sooner rigged by far, Thomas Tomkins complained in 1607, than a gentlewoman made ready. A hefty proportion of Queen Elizabeth's laces was supplied by Alice Montagu, a London silkwoman who also dealt in fine linen. On Ladies' Day 1576, for example, a list of items supplied by Alice for the Queen was issued that ran to 43 separate items, including 10 ounces of lace of Venise gold and silver. Over the next 6 months, the Queen bought yet more metal laces. The Michaelmas list includes £6 1 ounce of rich Venice lace made by hand, as well as £27 of bone lace and loom lace of Venice gold and silver of sundry sorts. It was also a popular gift. Quantities of lace and lace-trimmed clothing arrived from subjects and courtiers trying to curry favour. In honour of the new year of 1578, for example, she received a cushion cloth of lawn wrought with white work of branches and trees, edged with white bone lace wrought with crowns. The following year, the Countess of Lincoln gave her a long cloak of Murray velvet, with a border round about of small chain lace of Venice silver. Perhaps the most extravagant example of the genre came when she visited Kenilworth in 1584, and a suite was redecorated in eye-watering style in her honour. 5 plumes of coloured feathers, garnished with bone lace, and spangles of gold and of silver standing in cups, knit all over with gold, silver, and crimson silk, adorn the bedstead, of which the 5 curtains are striped down with a bone lace of gold and silver. Nor was the Queen alone in her tastes. Her great rival, Mary Queen of Scots, went to the scaffold in 1579 wearing white linen bobbin lace. 2 decades earlier, Sir Thomas Wyatt, another traitor to the crown, was beheaded wearing a fair hat of velvet with broad bonework lace about it, while the Comte de Saint-Maur, the leader of French fashion, left more than 300 pairs of lace-trimmed boot hose behind him when he was beheaded in 1642. The sensitivity of contemporaries to the nuances of lace can probably be judged from the row that developed between the artist Diego Velázquez and a young noblewoman of Saragossa. She refused to accept the finished portrait because, she said, the artist had failed to properly depict the quality of the lace, puntas de Flandes muy finas, of her collar. Frans Hals, The Laughing Cavalier, is a curious painting in many ways. It depicts a man who is neither a cavalier nor, indeed, is he laughing. The face of the 26-year-old sitter, his age is inscribed with the date 1624 on the portrait, is ruddy with health. His moustache curls irrepressibly upward, following the full lines of his cheeks. His lips and dark eyes, meanwhile, have the tilt of someone caught in the aftermath of a joke, of which he is inordinately proud. Nor is his wit the only thing this young man is pleased with. His clothes, from his vast black hat to his foaming ruff and the richly embroidered doublet, slashed over the upper arms to show the fine linen beneath, all telegraph wealth, status, and not a little vanity. But he was far from the only man of his era proud of his sartorial panache. In fact, despite the feminine connotations that lace has now, for much of this period it was worn far more by men. During the late 16th and 17th centuries, men habitually wore lace at their necks and wrists. Indeed, male clothes, particularly during the mid-17th century, offered far more opportunities for display. There was, for example, a vogue for wearing lace collars over armour. The effect of the delicate linen spread over the gleaming riveted metal, which can be seen in some Van Dyck portraits of the era, must have been very striking. Once ruffs had vanished from fashionable necks, men took to wearing exceptionally large, flat collars of delicate needle lace. Lace might also peak from the tops of boots, the seams of breeches and coats, or doublets, and even, while canyons were in fashion, in little frills around the knee. The masculine influence on lace extended to the motifs contained within it. A design of a surviving lace cravat end, which is thought to have once belonged to Louis XIV, contains stylized martial imagery, drums, standards, cannons, and 2 victorious trumpeting angels. Over the Channel, King James I was even more extravagant sartorially than his female predecessor. While the wardrobe expenses for the last 4 years of Queen Elizabeth's reign were £9,535, during the first 5 years of his, James I spent £36,377 annually. A good deal of this was incurred on lace. On the marriage of his daughter Elizabeth to the Elector Palatine in 1613, for example, a warrant was sent to the great wardrobe for 600 4-score and 18 ounce of silibone lace with spangles, 400 3-score and 7 ounce of gold and silver binding lace, 38 ounce of gold and silver loop lace, the list goes on. In all, over £1,100 of laces were listed. Nor was it just the fashion for royal men. During the 1590s, a vicious lawsuit played out between Lord Berkeley and his tailor. The former alleged that the latter had swindled him by using far less silver lace on one of the Lord's suits than he had reported, and pocketing the difference. It was actually a servant who noticed the discrepancy in the bill, which had included 40 ounces more lace than were actually found on the finished suit. In 1632, it was discovered that Charles I's taste for lace and fine linen was costing the realm £2,099 per annum. The public outcry following this revelation resulted in a plan being drawn up to reduce the expense of the royal wardrobe and a rather sulky monarch. He needn't have worried, the plan was never implemented, and the king was very soon beheaded. Royalist opponents, despite their protestations of sartorial humility, weren't immune. Oliver Cromwell, who died in 1658, and famous for his direction that he should be painted warts and all, was nevertheless buried in clothes trimmed with costly Flemish lace. Lace makers. A little thread descanted on by art and industry. Thomas Fuller on lace. The History of the Worthies of England, 1662. At first glance, the story of lace is one of luxury. But of course, there is always another side to be considered. The lace that garnished the throats of the wealthiest individuals in Europe, and still gleams whitely from their portraits, was often made, stitch by candlelit stitch, by some of the poorest. In some instances, needlework could function as a financial lifeline. On the 1st of September 1529, the city of Amsterdam decreed that all poor girls, old or young, who are unable to do any lace work or earn their keep, were to meet every morning before 6 o'clock and be taught free of charge spinning and other handiwork, whereby the same will be able to be kept and remain off the parish. Throughout this period, although the discovery of the New World and the exploitation of new trade routes swept a great deal of wealth into the coffers of the Old World, the gap between the rich and the poor widened. And although the wealthy were prepared to pay vast sums for lace, as we have seen, this money stubbornly refused to trickle down to those who made it. Part of the reason was that the lace makers, who were overwhelmingly female, didn't form corporations or guilds. This mattered because guilds functioned to give status to craftspeople who might lack it on an individual level. Without banding together, it was difficult to demonstrate the economic importance of their work or to demand higher wages and status in the same way passementiers and dyers were. The strictness of guilds could also stymie or restrict economic opportunity, however. Passementiers, for example, saw humble linen thread as beneath them, because working with precious metal was a guild privilege, and therefore missed out on lace-making work. Lace-makers, who often plied their needles and bobbins in informal family workshops, were too diffuse to organise. Gender also played into the low status and wages of lace-makers in other ways. So many women were taught needle skills as a matter of course that the potential workforce was very large, which depressed wages. The governor of Le Havre estimated that there were 20,000 lace-makers in the region in 1692. Lord Dorset gave a similar figure for all English lace-makers, although this seems a little low. Lorenzo Magalotti, who travelled through England with Cosimo de' Medici, wrote of Devonshire that there is not a cottage in all the county, nor in that of Somerset, where white lace is not made in great quantities, so that not only the whole kingdom is supplied with it, but it is exported in great abundance. In 1589, magistrates in Ghent passed a law to prevent servants from giving up their positions to become lace-makers. Only children under the age of 12 who still lived at home were permitted to continue making bobbin lace. A similar law was passed in the southern French city of Toulouse in 1649. So many women were engaged in making lace, the lawmakers grumbled, that finding domestic servants was becoming impossible. Moreover, they reasoned, lace wearing had become so widespread that it was no longer possible to confidently distinguish between les grandes et les petites. But although wages were clearly tempting, particularly in regions whose lace was suddenly buoyed by the whim of fashion, it was rarely secure employment. The industry expanded and contracted dramatically in response to changing tastes and economic conditions. When Colbert poured resources into the French lace-making centres in the 1660s, the Italians who had been busily engaged making Venetian gros-point found, almost overnight, that there was a good deal less demand for their wares. Lacemakers were also continually in danger of being undercut by the reservoirs of cheap, plentiful labour pent up in orphanages and nunneries. The gap between wages and the amounts that even the moderately well-off were paying for lace was vast. The account book of James Master, an English country gentleman, shows that while on the 7th of October 1651 he was happy to pay £3 for a little over a yard and three quarters of Flanders lace to make me a band and cuffs, 3 days later he paid his man Richard just £1.05 for his quarterly wages. This gulf goes some way to explaining why, contrary to the expectations of the city of Amsterdam, imparting bobbin lace skill to women did not inoculate the parish from the demands of the poor. A 1597 survey of the poor in Ipswich contained a forlorn entry for Elizabeth Grimstone, a widow in need of relief from the parish. "She maketh bone lace," the entry reads, "at a rate of 9 pence a week."